Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, in his inaugural address, President Barack Obama called for a new relationship between the United States and the Muslim world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect. How can the United States improve its relations with Muslim nations and Muslim communities around the globe? We'll talk with representatives of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. It's a bipartisan, multi-faith effort. The project would like to influence American leaders and American public opinion to develop a new direction for U.S. relations with the Muslim world, a direction emphasizing diplomacy and mutual understanding and respect between Americans and Muslims. We'll find out more with my guests. Thomas Dine, director of the Syria Project for the organization Search for Common Ground. They're one of the sponsoring organizations of the project. And he's former executive director of APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. Tom Dine, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Fred. Good to be with you.
And joining us, Dalia Mogahed is Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. It's a nonpartisan research center that recently completed a multinational survey of Muslim public opinion worldwide. Dalia Mogahed, good to have you here as well.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And when you'd like to join our conversation, after we lay a little groundwork, 614-292-8513. You can email brief comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. By the way, both of my guests will be speaking here in Columbus at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law on Friday, February 20th. We'll tell you more how to get free tickets to that project. Well, the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project, Dalia, recently issued a report whose recommendations, you said, should be an integral part of the next president's first 100 days. So which of the project's recommendations is President Obama already undertaking, would you say?
Well, I think he's done several things that would align very closely to the recommendations of the report, which is he included something about Muslims and improving relations in the inaugural address, which is, of course, the first time we've ever seen something like that. And his message was also in line with the report, where he talked about mutual interest and mutual respect, two aspects that the report really emphasized, that it's time to look at Muslims around the world as partners in solving the world's problems.
Mm-hmm. Tom Dine, of course, the recommendations of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project include negotiations, and I guess that's an emphasis for President Obama in terms of, let's say, Iran.
Oh, he was so far so good on everything he's done in his first three and a half weeks in office, not only mentioning, articulating those themes that Dalia just said. He's appointed George Mitchell, former senator, former Senate majority leader, former negotiator to resolve the Northern Ireland-British conflict. Mitchell will be dealing with the Palestine-Israel issue, and hopefully his mandate will expand on Syria-Israel. Mm-hmm. So we're waiting to see about that. Now he's got Dick Holbrooke as his representative on Pakistan-Afghanistan. That leaves Iran, as you just mentioned, and presumably that will be former ambassador on peace talks in the Israeli context. Dennis would be good on Iran, but so far nothing has been stated, and Dennis lurks in the halls of the State Department. People have seen him there, but no announcement has been made.
Mm-hmm. What do we know, Dalia, in terms of Muslim public opinion about President Obama?
Well, we know that there's a great deal of optimism and hope when it comes to President Obama. So we actually asked much of the world before our elections if they could vote, who would they want to see in the White House, President Obama or Senator McCain. And the world in general preferred Obama about 4-1, and the Muslim world was no exception. And so there was definitely a favorability toward Obama because of his message of internationalism and inclusivity.
Tom, there was a Predator drone missile strike in the Pakistan border area with Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago. That's a policy that President Bush had undertaken and continues apparently under President Obama. According to villagers, that strike killed three children, among others. And there, Bill Moyers showed a photograph of a large demonstration in Pakistan in which a sign in English said President Obama's first gift to Pakistan, bombs. So is this kind of action going to undercut accommodating words?
Well, remember in his inaugural, he also had something about hopefully you will unclench your fists. That was a statement that was an unusual statement, but it was basically aimed at those countries who do not wish the United States well. And right now, or not only countries, but individual groups, individuals, and they're scattered around the world, but particularly along that Pakistan-Afghanistan border. So Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Hamas, Hezbollah, those are four groups that do not reflect nation states, but they are, they do have arms, and they have been striking against American troops, American interests, and that's what we all need to focus on for sure.
Mm-hmm. But one expert on the Bill Moyers show a week ago Friday said suggested that these Predator drone strikes maybe kill one out of five people they kill might be a dangerous militant, but the others are probably civilians. So I wonder if this doesn't act counter to President Obama's expressed wish to have a new understanding based on respect between Americans and Muslims.
It may act counter, that's true. But we don't know for sure who's being hit and who's not being hit. And therefore, the American military has to have some kind of accountability and some kind of cost-benefit analysis. Now that sounds mean-spirited, but it's not. It's about, are we really hitting our targets, or are we really just scattering it? The old saying, it's better to use a rifle than a shotgun. But in this case, we don't know who's being hit.
Dahlia, your thoughts about this issue?
I think that it will be something that President Obama has to think about very carefully, because, like you said, when civilian casualties occur, these have a ripple effect throughout the world, not only the Muslim world, but indeed throughout the world. And so we do have to think about how these actions are being felt on the ground, and the cost-benefit analysis, as Tom pointed out. Would another approach perhaps be closer to our strategic goals, such as using intelligence to go in and arrest these individuals that we believe are planning, planning attacks on our country, and have get intelligence from them, and perhaps prevent further attacks without the civilian casualties of the Predator attack.
Mm. You know, Fred, excuse me a minute.
Yes.
I think what Dahlia just said is how difficult all this is. I'm aware of an attack by American troops that in Syria, they crossed from Iraq. That took place, I believe, in September. September or October, but doesn't make any difference. It was a violation of sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And the predators, these people-less airplanes that fly overhead, are they a violation of sovereignty? How accurate are they? All these questions are constantly coming up. And whose sovereignty and when and why but it's part of the clenched fist versus diplomacy, and this is really tough stuff. As Dahlia and I are in favor of conflict resolution, and how do you do that is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with representatives of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. It's a bipartisan, multi-faith effort to develop a new direction for U.S. relations with the Muslim world. a direction emphasizing diplomacy and mutual understanding and respect between Americans and Muslims. Dalia Mogahed is executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. Tom Dine, director of the Syria Project for the organization's Search for Common Ground. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email questions or comments to openline@wosu.org. Tom, you've talked about, in your words, the common ground that exists between the peoples and government of the United States and global Muslim societies. Tell us more about that common ground.
Thanks. Well, as President Obama said, we've got to find knowledge. And what we're concerned with is how knowledgeable is the United States with the Muslim world? When the word Muslim is used in the United States, often it connotes the Arab-speaking world. But in fact, the larger world of Muslims extends from Morocco over to Indonesia, and they're not Arab speakers. Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world. The second is Pakistan. The third actually is India. None of those are Arab speaking. So we've got to expand our knowledge, we the United States, we the American people, and that requires a look at our educational system, both at the higher level as well as grade school and high school.
When you say common ground, though, between the United States and Muslim societies, tell us more about that common ground. What do we share in common?
Well, we all want reconciliation and we all want peace. How do we achieve that is very difficult, and we've had differences for the 400 years that there's been in America. There are a couple of books on the history of Americans in the Arab world, for instance, and it all came to a head shortly after our independence when pirates in the Mediterranean started overwhelming American commercial ships. And so we've had difficulties all along, and it just takes good diplomacy, good knowledge, and an orientation which is not warfare and stops looking at people as terrorists.
Dalia, you said that for too long, U.S. policy toward the Muslim world has been shaped by, in your words, a vocal fringe silencing the majority. Tell us more about that.
Yes, what we've really found in our research at Gallup is that when we ask ordinary people what they think, it looks a lot closer to what ordinary Americans think than does the talking heads or the vocal extremists that we find on television. And so there is this vocal fringe that is silencing the majority who are basically telling us that they reject both the extreme of believing that the West is out to destroy Islam or that Islam is out to destroy the West. And what they have very clearly told us in our research is that they are interested in better relations with the West in general, but specifically with the United States. That what's really at the heart of the conflict is not a hatred of our values, but really an issue of politics and things that can be changed, things that are not inherent to our society or theirs.
So in other words, you're saying the great mass of opinion, both in the Muslim world and here in the United States, is rejecting this idea of that we've heard bruited about an inevitable clash of civilizations, Christian and Islamic. People don't believe that.
No, they don't believe that. And they probably view the history of the relationship between Muslims and the United States more broadly. Now, Tom pointed out some of the issues, some of the problems with the pirates in the Mediterranean. What might be more sort of closer to people's minds, because most people actually don't really know anything about the pirate problem with the United States during that time, is the relationship that many Muslims had with the United States that was rather positive in terms of the U.S. being the only Western power without a colonial legacy, that the United States stood up in many cases for Muslim-majority countries against colonial powers when they were fighting for independence. That the United States, for better or worse, actually supported the, quote, Muslim side in the conflict with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So there are the things that come closer to people's memory and concept of history is actually an overall positive relationship between Muslims everywhere and the United States. And from the point of view of many Muslims, the problems are much less deep-rooted than some might think, that they did occur, as Obama pointed out in his interview with Al Arabiya, in the last few decades.
So in other words, if you look back to the 40s and the 50s, there were pretty amicable relations between the Muslim world and the United States.
Yes.
But that's changed. What's changed? Is it the Persian Gulf War, the war in Iraq? I mean, what have there been policy actions of the United States that have altered Muslim public opinion?
Well, if I could just say something
about
one more example, Dalia, is with the American role in ending genocide in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm. Of course, exactly. Yes, I think that's an excellent example of where the United States played a positive role, as well as Kosovo, I would add.
Right.
And I think one other thing that often gets forgotten is, even at the very beginning, the first country to recognize this new radical notion of an independent United States was, in fact, Morocco, first country to recognize the United States as an independent country. So there really is a long history of trade and of diplomatic relations that were overall positive. And many see the recent conflict as the exception.
Gotcha. In a long history of amicable relations. So what is it? What policies of the U.S., if it was policies of the U.S., turned Muslim public opinion against the United States? Because when you look at Muslim public opinion around the world of the U.S., it's not very favorable.
Sure. Well, I would say that things started to really turn with Gulf War I, which is often a surprise to people. But before that, Muslims really saw the Soviet Union as an anti-religion, which it was, of course, force, and that the United States was, after all, a Christian country. And so they felt that they were closer to what Muslims felt that they were in terms of at least having an Abrahamic tradition. Gulf War I was a lot more harmful than I think we may have understood at the time. And then after Gulf War I, the sanctions that were put on Iraq and the effects on children and old people and so forth really started to turn public opinion against the United States. But what really dramatically made it worse and made it worse outside of the Arab world into the greater Muslim world was the invasion of Iraq in 2003. There was a dramatic drop after that occurred.
According to UN estimates, the sanctions on Iraq after the Persian Gulf War resulted in the deaths of over 500,000 children because of the lack of medical supplies, clean water, bombed out by the war, etc. So that made a real impact in the Muslim world, I would think.
It did, and now it didn't make it into our nightly news very often, but it was something that people in the region were aware of, and it was really thought of as a very cruel collective punishment of the Iraqi people for a leader that they essentially couldn't control.
In between these two critical points that Dalia points out, the Gulf War I and then the invasion of Iraq, we haven't mentioned the 9/11, which of course deeply and divisively affected American opinion toward the Muslim world and how that came about. But which gets back to an earlier point that all of us are making, is that to take Dalia's term, the vocal fringe, It's those who, in the name of Islam, have created so much havoc and so much violence, and then the American response, it's almost the hostility has almost become a two-way street, and we've got to deal with that. And I think that's where you get back to education and accuracy in reporting.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I think Tom is absolutely right, and I think 9/11 has really fundamentally, deepened this conflict and made it much harder to resolve. What we find in our research is that 9/11 is broadly rejected by the general public, and that in many ways Muslims around the world are more worried about being victims of terrorists than even our Americans. And so we really need to start to think of terrorism as a mutual threat,
mm-hmm.
And a mutual enemy. Because after all, the primary target of terrorists, of course, are Muslims. They make up the majority of victims of terrorists in the region.
Mm-hmm. So the great majority of Muslim public opinion is saying regards terrorism a real threat to themselves. So that's something else they have in common with the people of the United States.
But it's an interesting, if you were a historian, and it's too early to be a historian about all this, you get a series of events, Gulf War I, 9/11, invasion of Iraq, and then this continuing daily adverse effect that terrorism has had, and all those body counts on almost a nightly basis in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere, and it's cruel, and it's very sad.
Yeah. Joining us on the phone here is Ahmed. Hi, you're on the line.
Yes, how are you doing, Ed? How are you today?
Good.
You know, you have such a great collection of guests. But, you know, there's one thing that hasn't been mentioned yet, that the relationship to Israel. I mean, that's the number one cause of animosity between the Muslim world and the United States, this blind support for Israel. And that hasn't been mentioned yet.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Okay, good.
Okay.
The other thing is what Tom said, that he just obliterated a list of all the groups that the United States has named as terrorist groups, and he says all of these groups have done something against the United States, and that's not true, not all of them. And the other thing is the support for all these dictators, and you cannot say Muslim countries and Muslim people. It's totally different, because you have all these dictators that the United States are supporting who are torturing, imprisoning the Muslims. Okay, and then the last thing, and I'll get off the air. Right now, the Muslim world, which is one of the biggest customers for American cars, American products, okay, American manufacturers, right now the Muslim world and the rest of the world, and I don't mean just the Arab world, is not buying American products.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is what that's all they can do. So these are the issues that have to be examined and have to be studied.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate you letting me talk.
Thank you for making these points. We're going to take a break here and see whether our guests agree or disagree that the United States has shown a blind support for Israel. Whether that's a perception in the Muslim world, we don't know. But we're going to find out more about that and the other issues that our caller raised after we take these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
O'clock used to mean quitting time. Not so much anymore.
As long as you've got a plug and a good wireless connection, can work increasing hours and in completely odd hours all the time.
I'm Neil Conan, Elsewhere USA. How we got from 5 o'clock quitting time and family dinners to the home office and crackberry moms. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That discussion and much more on Talk of the Nation later this afternoon, beginning at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Our winter membership drive begins soon, and you can do your part to help WOSU reach our $175,000 goal. Every dollar we raise between now and February 18th will become a part of the WOSU Member Challenge Fund. But how soon we reach the goal all depends on you. Make your gift today. It's a great way to inspire new and existing members to give as well. Make your gift online right now at WOSU.org. And thank you for your support of WOSU 820, NPR News. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, partly sunny today and a warm day with a high of 58. Increasing clouds overnight, bringing in the possibility of a rain shower after midnight and a low of 48. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy and rain likely throughout the day, a high of 58. Currently 36 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now, back to Open Line with Fred Anderle.
And welcome back to Open Line, a WOSU 820 NPR News. We're talking with representatives of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. It's a bipartisan, multi-faith effort. The project would like to influence American leaders and American public opinion to develop a new direction for U.S. relations with the Muslim world, a direction emphasizing diplomacy and mutual understanding and respect between Americans and Muslims. Joining us, Dalia Mogahed is executive director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, a nonpartisan research center. They recently completed a multinational survey of Muslim public opinion worldwide. Tom Dine, director of the Syria Project for the organization Search for Common Ground. That's one of the two founding organizations of the Engagement Project. He's a former executive director of APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Both of my guests are going to be speaking Friday, February 20th. That's a week from this coming Friday. Friday, February 20th. 3:30 in the afternoon in Saxby Auditorium at Ohio State's Moritz College of Law. Now, the presentation is sponsored by OSU's Mershon Center for International Security Studies and the university's Middle East Studies Center. Now, tickets are free, but you must register for the tickets. So in order to do that, you go online at mershoncenter.osu.edu. That's Mershon Center, and Mershon is M-E-R-S-H-O-N. So Mershon Center, as one word, .osu.edu. For ticket information, there are about 170-some tickets. They're free, but you must register, and we'll repeat all that information again for you as we move along. Well, our caller, Ahmed Tom Dine, brought up the idea of the Israeli-Palestinian, the tragic conflict that continues, and he suggested that he felt, or maybe Muslim public opinion felt, I don't know, that the United States have been very one-sided in support of Israel. Let's talk about that. What do you think?
Well, I don't agree with that claim at all. Yes, the United States does support Israel. In fact, indeed, there's a very close, strong relationship, but it's not blind. Support for Israel is natural because of shared values and democratic system of government in Israel, and it has been deemed over many administrations that Israel is in the interest of the United, support for Israel is in the interest of the United States. However, that doesn't mean the United States supports everything that Israel does, including the 1967 war occupancy of the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, every administration has tried to work with Israel and Palestinians to try to achieve some kind of reconciliation. And now it is declared American policy, as it is Israeli policy, to support a two-state solution, a free, independent Palestine and a free, independent Israel. And that's certainly what the Mitchell effort is going to be, was last week, and will continue to be in the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. Dalia Mogahed, what do we know about Arab and Muslim public opinion perceptions about the relationship between the United States, Israel, and Palestinians?
Right. Well, the perception is certainly that it is one-sided and biased, and whether that perception is true or false, you know, I think it's up to everyone to sort of figure out on their own. But it's very clear in the data that that is the perception of Muslims around the world, that the United States does favor Israel in the conflict. That said, this issue is of special importance, especially to Arabs, regardless of being Muslim or not, in fact. But the Arab people do consider the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as something that is central to their engagement with the United States, and a resolution of that conflict would improve U.S. standing in the region dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you move outside of the region, of the Arab world, it becomes less and less important. Not that people have a fundamentally different perception of the U.S.'s the nature of the U.S. relationship with Israel, but just that that relationship is of lower priority. So people in Muslim Asia and Muslim Africa are less focused on the conflict. It's not the central narrative that defines their perception of the United States, whereas it really is for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. So Muslims outside that area are not as concerned. Why does it resonate so deeply? What is it about this conflict that resonates deeply in Arab Muslim public opinion?
Well, I think that's a very complicated and important question. It has to do with history. Many of the countries surrounding the area have actually fought wars with Israel. It has to do with Palestinian refugees being in many of these countries. It has to do with just a historical narrative that people have heard and understood, have been internalized in the past generation. And so it will dramatically, we believe, improve our ability to engage Muslims around the world when this conflict is resolved. And that's why it's one of our major recommendations, is that we focus on resolving these acute conflicts that were either engaged in directly with Muslims or indirectly.
Mm-hmm. So the appointment of George Mitchell to listen, at least in his first tour of the Middle East, is probably a very good idea.
Yes, it's a very important move. And as Tom said, it was something that we specifically recommended and was carried out in the first 100 days.
Mm-hmm. Is there a role? I guess you prefer diplomacy and negotiation, but do you, Tom? Is there, in terms of the Muslim U.S. Engagement project, is there a role for military action in the estimate of the project?
Well, if you pursue engagement rather than isolation and disengagement, if you pursue people-to-people efforts, if you pursue a policy that doesn't see the world as black and white, enemies and friends, and nobody in between, then you're left often with military option, military conflict, and we'd like to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. You're implying that that's how the Bush administration saw the world. Huh?
Well, it's no secret. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So you see a shift in President Obama in terms of that kind of perception then?
Right off the bat, mm-hmm. just by his inaugural address, as we both have spoken about, that was really right off our game plan,
mm-hmm.
And we were all very tickled. Then the appointment of two envoys so far, George Mitchell and Dick Holbrook, to areas of conflict. Resolving conflict is now a major point to Obama diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Another point our caller Ahmed brought up, that we've too often supported dictatorships in the Arab world, according to our caller, and in fact have worked against democratic reform movements in those countries. That was a complaint from about a year ago from former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She said the United States, she thought, had made a mistake in doing that. Dalia Mogahed, again, is that a perception in the Arab world, that we have indeed supported dictatorships at the expense of democracy when it suited our interests?
Yes, that is certainly a perception. If I can just actually list the three major prisms or filters through which Muslims around the world have viewed American actions and words.
Mm-hmm.
So the three major issues are the issue of acute conflicts, including Iraq and also conflicts that we're indirectly involved in, like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And two is this perception of political domination and support for dictatorships when it suits our interests. And then the third is this overarching perception of disrespect, which I think we'll probably talk about a little later, and Tom has touched on several times with this idea of mutual understanding and better education. But the second of these three major topics is this issue of supporting the perception of not really being sincere about allowing people the right to elect their own government and the right to fashion their own political future.
Mm-hmm. And an accurate perception, you're both saying.
In many cases, it is an accurate perception. In other cases, it's probably a lot more complicated. The important thing is that we need to understand the filters through which people perceive what we do and say. And when we do that, we can truly lead the world because our policies will have their intended effect. And we also have to think about which policies we want to pursue in light of what our principles are.
You know, interesting. First of all, these three filters, these three acute conflicts, are really right on target. And everywhere you go in the Middle East, as well as outside the Middle East, you feel them, you see them, and you have to talk about them. Yet at the same time, there's some contradictions. Every time the United States says, well, we need democracy in Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, then we're warned we're going to create instability. And that also is a part of, is seen as playing against American policy and American interests. And then Muslims will say, quit trying to dictate what kind of system of government we all have. So we can't win right now. But I think if we show more respect and more understanding, we'll and more involvement with reconciling the Palestinian-Israel conflict, we'll see more. I think we'll see much more agreement on this.
Well, you know, then of course we say we support democratic elections, but then when Hamas, which we view as a terrorist organization and reasonably so, wins seats in the Palestinian parliament in what everybody says was a pretty free and open democratic election, we work to undermine those leaders. So how does that sit?
It doesn't. This is an ongoing problem.
Mm-hmm. Dalia, by the way, let me mention once again our guests here from the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project. Again, it's a bipartisan, multi-faith effort. They would like to develop a new direction or influence American leaders and American public opinion to develop a new direction for U.S. relations with the Muslim world, emphasizing diplomacy, mutual understanding, and respect. Tom Dine, director of the Syria Project for the organization Search for Common Ground. Now, they were one of the founding organizations of the Engagement Project. He's former executive director of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Dalia Mogahed is executive director for the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, a nonpartisan research center. They recently completed a multinational survey of Muslim public opinion worldwide. Now, my guests are going to be speaking here in Columbus Friday, February 20th. That's a week from this coming Friday. So Friday, February 20th, 3:30 in the afternoon in Saxby Auditorium at OSU's Moritz College of Law. Now, they're sponsored by OSU's Mershon Center for International Security Studies and the university's Middle East Studies Center. Now, tickets are free, but you have to register. So to do that, go to mershoncenter.osu.edu, and Mershon, E-D-U, I should say, and Mershon is M-E-R-S-H-O-N. So Mershon Center, as one word, .osu.edu. Go to their events calendar, and you'll find a direct way to register and get your tickets for Friday, February 20th, 3:30, U.S. Muslim Engagement Projects, my speakers here today. Again, Dalia Mogahed, Executive Director of the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies, Tom Dine, Director of the Syria Project for the Search for Common Ground. And you can call in this morning or give us a brief email, 614-292-8513, or open line at WOSU.org. Dali, you'd mentioned the perception in the Muslim world that we disrespect. Now, is it a disrespect they feel of Islam, the religion, or of them as a people, or what?
That's a very good question, and it's a complicated question. It's probably all of the above. We've heard this mostly in open-ended questions. When we ask people, what can the West do to improve relations with the Muslim world, the most frequent response we hear, whether we're talking to someone in Morocco or Indonesia, is this issue of showing greater respect and viewing Muslims as equal human beings. So the issue of respect has to do with a combination of the perception that Islam as a faith is not being respected, but also that Muslims as people are being looked down upon as not fully equal to Americans in many cases. That perception sometimes stems from what we just talked about, the lack of support for people's right to fashion their own political future, or pictures that I think horrified the world out of Abu Ghraib. And it's precisely because we stand for democratic values, and in fact that's what we're most admired for by Muslims, that when we are perceived to treat them in a way that is not consistent with those democratic values, the only explanation people can come up with is that we don't view them as equals.
Because we profess, and they see here at home, we have open elections, free elections, the full democracy, and then we treat them differently, and the conclusion is, well, we don't respect them, we don't see them as equals. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Let us go to our callers here, and our first one is Mark. Hello, Mark.
Is that me?
Yep.
Yeah, I just read a fascinating book by Bernard, I'm not sure how to pronounce
Lewis,
his last name, Avishay.
Oh, don't know.
The Hebrew Republic. And it talked about a constitution for Israel, which protects minority rights. And I was wondering about expanding that into, like, the territories, what the people on your panel would think about. Are the people there, the Arabs and the Israelis, ready to have a republic, a democratic republic, perhaps have a single constitution from both countries that protects minority rights in the same way, and have a two-state solution that way? I haven't heard any much response, and it doesn't seem there's much groundswell for this, but it seems like a fascinating idea, and I was wondering if I can get a comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Tom Dine, your thoughts.
Whether or not Israel has a written constitution has been a debate from its founding. But I don't think that that's going to resolve the fact that it occupies a piece of territory or pieces of territory alongside it, in which Palestinians want a homeland. And I think so there are actually two issues here. Number one, how to treat the Palestinians outside of Israel, and secondly, how to treat Palestinians, Arabs, inside Israel. And the two are slightly different. Inside Israel, 19% of the Israeli population are Arabs, both Christian and Islamic. And those folks are not being treated equally, and it's well known in the educational system, the benefits from the economy. By the way, a booming economy. And I would definitely support, and I have supported in my career, dealing with those minorities as best as possible and to have a fully equal society. On outside of designated Israel is the Palestinian homeland and the need for a two-state solution. Israel cannot exist as a Jewish democratic state in keeping to a one state because of demographics, and it just won't work over the long run, over the next 20 years. So from a security point of view, from a Jewish state point of view, there needs to be a Palestinian state, and besides the fact that the Palestinians deserve their own state and want their own state. So I don't think a constitution will make a bit of difference whether it goes whichever way it goes. I don't know the book to which you're referring, so I can't comment on it. But yes, the minorities, the Druze, the Arabs inside Israel need to be treated as equal. And outside of Israel, we need a Palestinian state.
All right. Let's continue forward here with Al. Hello, Al. You're on the line.
Yes. I have five sources that support my opinion that we should just leave Afghanistan. We have no achievable goals. I have five different sources that have agreed with that opinion that I developed some time ago. And let me quickly tick them off. If we kill bin Laden and even some of his leaders...
Well, we have to be brief here, caller.
Okay, well, read the letter I sent you.
All right. Do you have a question for our panelists?
We should just leave Afghanistan because there's no achievable goals. We're in the same trap that the Persians, the British, and Russia were in, and there's no way. And it's hurting our goodwill to everybody in the world, not only the Muslims.
Well, let's ask a caller, hang on the line, and let's ask Dalia Mogahed, our presence in Afghanistan. Do we have a measure of Muslim public opinion about that?
We do, actually. And people, which is often surprising to many of us, people in majority Muslim countries do not differentiate very much between Afghanistan and Iraq. They're both seen as, an aggressive military invasion. Now, from our side, I think we see the two as very, very different. That difference is really much less pronounced in the Muslim world, although, there is some acceptance of the fact that bin Laden is, of course, attacked America and that, therefore, attacking Afghanistan is acceptable. The idea being that it should have been taken, basically people's point of view about terrorism is that it is a law enforcement issue because terrorism in their own countries, that's exactly how it's treated. It's how we would treat our own domestic terrorism. It's law enforcement. So they expected a law enforcement response to 9/11 and going in and taking out bin Laden instead of an actual military invasion. So the perception of both Afghanistan and Iraq is seen very negatively, and the sooner we can leave Afghanistan as in a responsible way, I think the better.
Mm-hmm. Although,
Listen, Fred, one of the most interesting things of all is how pro-American the Afghan people are. The American Radio Free Afghanistan is the most popular radio in Afghanistan today. It beats the BBC. It beats state radio, Afghan state radio. 65% annually listen to, or I should say weekly, listen to Radio Free Afghanistan. And it's a credit to the technique and the standard, the high standards, and also the orientation of the people.
But if it's accurate to say, and the Gallup organization has polled Muslim countries worldwide, that indeed Muslim public opinion it doesn't differentiate between Iraq and Afghanistan, as far as they're concerned, it would be better if we left. I don't see President Obama, at least so far, moving toward the idea of taking our troops out of Afghanistan. In fact, he's talking about the potential of adding up to 30,000 more troops.
Right. No, that's true. And I think what Tom is saying is also true. Afghanistan is one of the most pro-American country in that region, in sort of the South Asia, Middle East area. Definitely much, much more pro-American than is Pakistan right next door. And so there is a lot more nuance when you consider what the people in the country are saying and feeling. I'm more really explaining the greater Muslim world from the point of view of their vantage point. They feel that it's an invasion and so forth, and compare it, in fact, to the invasion of the Soviet Union.
Okay, Al must move on. Thanks for your call. We have several emails here, and I'll read them. An email from Sean. Sean says, the Muslim educational system seems to stress fundamentalism and a literal translation of the Quran and Hadith. There is a This, he says, is a gateway to terrorism. Sean asks, what can we do to stop this without having to resort to a nuclear confrontation with the Muslim world? That's Sean's opinion. Anybody like to comment on that?
I can go ahead and comment on that. The educational system in Muslim-majority countries actually varies dramatically from one country to another. There are countries where religion is hardly taught, to others, of course, where it's very emphasized. But what we found in our data is that sympathy for terrorism does not correlate with religiosity or religious education, in fact. What sympathy for terrorism, I'm talking about public sympathy for terrorism, correlates with is not one's view of our culture or even their social conservatism, but rather their view of their own government and our government's policies. So it's really much more of a political ideology that leads to sympathy for terrorism rather than a fundamentalist religious interpretation. And I'll just give you one example of that. When we ask people to explain their response about 9/11, when they explain to us, so we tell them to tell us if they thought 9/11 was justified. After their response, we actually ask them a follow-up question, and we ask them to tell us why they say what they did. What we heard from people who condemn 9/11, who say that it was wrong, is actually religious explanations of that position. They say that God hates murder, that it's against Islam to kill civilians. Those who agree with 9/11 or say that it's completely justified, that minority do not give religious justifications for their response. They talk about their really very secular socio-political perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Such as?
Well, they call America a colonial power, an imperialist power. They talk about that America kills civilians, and so this is what they deserve. They talk in terms of revenge and politics instead of religion or piety.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of Muslims that you surveyed worldwide think 9/11 was justified?
Well, if we look at an overall percentage, we would say 7% thought 9/11 was completely justified and have unfavorable opinions of the United States. In the book, we call this group the politically radicalized.
All right. I have an email from Henry. It says, some news from the Muslim world, says Henry. The Muslims overseas are very, very skeptical about the U.S. as an honest broker. And that Mr. Obama is giving the typical lip service again, and he, as other American leaders, have said a lot but done very little. Presumably he's talking about the Israel-Palestinian situation. Tom Dine, would you like to tackle that one? Henry feels that Muslims don't see us as an honest broker, and they don't see Barack Obama as any different.
Yes, there was an article yesterday indicating that because he didn't speak out against the Gaza war, because he was not yet president, they felt that it was just going to be life as usual in America, leaning heavily toward Israel. And I just don't think that's going to be true. I think, first of all, by appointing George Mitchell, and I said this earlier, that was a very important first move. George Mitchell is one of the most fair individuals I've ever known, and I've known him before he became a senator. He basically is a judge and looks at life and tries to evaluate which side is right and tries to be fair. Mm-hmm. And he'll carry that attribute into these into the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I think he's the right choice at the right time for the right reason.
All right. My guest Tom Dine and Dalia Magahed of the U.S. Muslim Engagement Project, again, a bipartisan multi-faith effort. And just to tell you finally here, my guest will be speaking Friday, February 20th. That's a week from this coming Friday, the 20th, 3:30 in the afternoon in Saxby Auditorium at OSU's Moritz College of Law. And here is where you go for information. Tickets are free, but you have to register online at mershoncenter.osu.edu. And Mershon is spelled M-E-R-S-H-O-N. So Mershon Center is one word, .osu.edu for your tickets for Friday, February 20th, 3:30 in the afternoon. Dalia Magahed, Tom Dine, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
When we come back after the news, animal scientist Temple Grandin says animals make us human. I'm listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 is NPR News.